Hey, everybody. Welcome to the latest edition of the Mobile Cast. We are here in sunny Denver. Right now, Bri Forum is going on in downtown Denver, and we're here with episode 204, so the fourth episode of the second season. And I am sitting here with Justin Marston, the CEO of Hypori. And Justin, introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about Hypori and what it does.
Sure. So my name is Justin Marston. I'm the CEO and co-founder at Hypori, and we do virtual mobile infrastructure.
What's virtual mobile infrastructure? I mean, my listeners, I would say, would know what VDI is, but VMI is a little bit different. So why don't we actually, before we do that, notice your British accent. At least I'm assuming it's a British accent. I've mixed up Brits and Aussies before, much to my chagrin. I assume you're originally from England?
Yes, I grew up near Manchester, and then I lived in London before coming here.
Okay, so here's the big one. Who do you support? What's your footy team?
I don't watch it as much now, but it probably would have been Manchester United at the time. It was the closest decent team.
Okay, so we're not going to kick you off the podcast. Huge Manchester United fan here. I was actually originally considering going to San Jose, but they changed the venue, so there weren't as many tickets available. Man United's playing San Jose this weekend. But anyway, explain to us what virtual mobile infrastructure is, you know, what the differences are, what it means.
Sure. So whereas virtual desktop infrastructure is providing you remote access to a Windows desktop PC running, you know, remotely, virtual mobile infrastructure is really about providing access to a virtual Android smartphone or a virtual Android mobile device that's running on a server in the cloud. And so you can have your iPad, your iPhone, or your Android device. You click into a client similar to accessing an RDP client. And then when you hit connect, you're now looking at this video stream of an Android, you know, virtual machine that's running on a server.
So, you know, for those of you that are familiar with VDI, desktop as a service, even remote app streaming, it's somewhat similar to that on the desktop, but I'm not necessarily streaming like for like. I'm actually taking an Android OS and Android apps, and I can see that on my iPhone, my iPad, iPod Touch, certainly any Apple device. Do you support Windows mobile devices or BlackBerry at the moment?
We don't support BlackBerry, and you know, we only have a very small number of customers at this point that have asked about that. Windows, we're in the process of doing the port.
And is that because you hear a lot of people who are saying they'd like to run Android apps on Windows? I mean, with Windows Universal, we're going to dig into obviously what VMI is and what you, Hypori, do. But is that because you think there's going to be a huge market for it? Because, you know, Microsoft's talked about universal apps and being able to take an Android app and, you know, very easily port it over. I don't know how much of that's true until I actually see it for myself. But, you know.
Sure. So some of our customers are in the DoD and the intelligence community, and they have an appreciation for the physical device security features of Windows. So there are some things that you can do in a Windows device today, like attestation, hardware root to trust, that are harder to do or not really done as much yet in mobile devices. Android is getting there. NSA is working with the Google open source with this SE Android project, and there are trusted execution environments and things. But at the moment, still, you know, there are folks that want to use Windows tablets. And it really comes down to the availability of the apps and the user experience. So Android is very similar to iOS, and, you know, they have very similar user experiences, and users already know how to use it. So one aspect is more people know how to use iOS and Android than know how to use Windows 10. The second issue is the actual availability of the app catalogs. So there's 1.5 million apps in, you know, the iOS and Android app stores today. There's, I don't know, less than 100,000 in the Windows one. And, you know, whenever you do a hands up in the room of who's developing Windows apps for, you know, Windows touch-based devices, it's an extremely small number.
To be fair, we were in a session a little while ago from Jack Madden, Gabe Knuth talking about this, and they asked who was developing either Metro apps or Universal apps, and not a single hand went up in a room of, you know, 30, 40 people. So
right, and I think that the code migration stuff that Microsoft is trying to work on with things like Project Astoria are reflections of the inability to generate an app ecosystem around the Windows platform on mobile. So there are just key apps that are missing. And getting access to those apps, getting access to a version that's been written from the ground up for touch. You know, the whole of the OS and all of the apps were written for touch. They were written for small screens. You know, that doesn't really exist today in Windows. You have this kind of half over the fence. You know, you get back to a Windows full desktop experience with a start and a drop-down bar, and you also have this kind of touch veneer on top of it. So I think access to apps, the user ultimately just wants to do their work and wants this mobile-first experience where it's like the things that they're used to on their personal devices.
So let's take a step back and talk about Hypori from the beginning. You guys are a startup still. How old are you?
We are right around 4 years.
Okay. What led you into doing this for Hypori? Sure. What was the genesis of this?
So I was running another company in the trusted kind of computing area. We were doing mashup applications spanning classified network domains in the DoD. And we had a meeting with two senior technical executives from the National Security Agency. And we talked about trying to get apps onto mobile devices. And they said, you know, don't worry about porting the few apps you've got. The problem is we don't have anything right now on mobile. And there's two things that we worry about. We worry about data at rest. Somebody loses their phone and there's data on it, that data is recoverable. And even if you remote wipe it, half of the manufacturers, even if you reset it to factory settings, it's still there on the flash memory because it's just really hard to delete stuff off flash memory. And I can talk more about that if you're interested. The second problem was attestation. How do I know there's no malware on this device? How do I know that it has a good boot state? And that's very hard on devices with limited CPU and battery, right? And so NSA had already decided they wanted to move the place that the apps were running to the cloud. They wanted a thin client. And they had experimented as part of this fishbowl program with browser-based thin clients, and they actually had to go in and modify Firefox to try and make sure it didn't cache things, because just because you've got HTML5, it doesn't mean you don't have data at rest. So they had to go and create a custom browser. But they still found the user experience was just not great, didn't have the apps they wanted. And then they tried doing, you know, remote Windows as well, and various parts of the government have tried that. And the problem has been, you know, the user experience is just not good. It's kind of tolerable-ish on a tablet for occasional use, but it's not, it just isn't great for regular day-to-day use. And then on a smartphone, it's still awful. You know, it's just not designed for the device. So those are the two things that they had tried. And, you know, we had the idea of, well, what if, you know, we provided remote access to Android? What if we built a mobile first VDI platform? And, you know,
you use the dreaded VDI term there, just pointing it out.
Right.
We're at Briform. You know, Brian Madden and Gabe Knuth had published the VDI Delusion, but yeah. That's sort of where you started from.
Yes. And then we moved. So we, you know, we started developing the project and developing the technology. And, you know, we're grateful for the collaboration we've had with various parts of the DoD over the last 4 years. But it's a very difficult technology to build. And so we're fond of saying, you know, it's easy to build a demo. It's really hard to build a product. 98% of the iceberg is underwater. You know, and that's why VDI today is still dominated by three vendors, and none of the open source and, you know, startups funded by venture firms have ever chipped away much of that. One of the big reasons is it's really hard to remote an OS. And so, you know, that's how we got our start. We've been working on it for the last 4 years, and then we came out of stealth just under a year ago with a version 3 of our platform. And then, you know, here at Briforum, we've just done a press release and announced version 3.1 where we've added in some more key features.
So before we get to that now, let's be fair, because just to let the listeners know, we're lucky enough to have three different VMI vendors here at Briform, and the goal here is actually to get the other two on podcast right after you. So to be fair, but you know, it sounds like you guys may have been the start of this. You know, there are about six companies out there that do this, but you seem to have had an advantage because you were working with the DoD, the government, these pieces that really needed this. So you actually probably had a slightly different set of criteria than some of these other companies did.
I think the interesting thing with DoD is, you know, they've spent a lot of money historically on custom special phones to try and do classified communications.
Black phone, and, lockdown, you know, lock, you,
yeah, lockdown, speedpad, yeah. You know, special.
Boeing's, you know, jet, Boeing's building a $9,000 phone, as I understand,
yeah,
so.
Yeah, yeah, Boeing has the black, and they built, they spent $20 million on SMEPED before that, and there's a long history. And so recently, NSA decided, and it was a really, you know, intelligent decision, that they couldn't keep up with the rate of evolution of commercial technology. And, you know, they would spend all this money on a project, it would already be dead. So they developed this commercial solutions for classified strategy, and you can read about it on NSA's website. But the basic idea was, we only want to use commercial technologies, and we want to configure them in a secure way to allow the senior, you know, leaders of the country and special forces and others to use it. But we don't want to be building our own phones. We really don't want to be rolling our own ROMs, our own, you know, Android distributions. We really want to be using, you know, commercial off-the-shelf software like AirWatch, like ourselves. And so because of that, that really colored their whole mentality and thinking about projects like and platforms like VMI. So that, you know, the DoD has been very interested in how commercial is viewing VMI, what commercial requirements are, and not trying to take you down a rabbit hole where, you know, it's a special product that's a separate branch. They haven't done it with VMware. They haven't done it with other commercial products. You know, their goal is to use the commercial product. And so they have this commercial solutions for classified list, which is kind of the ones, the vendors that are approved for being used on classified networks. We're on that list. You can look us up, look for component list, NSA, CSFC. We're the only VMI vendor on that. And we're going through common criteria on the server and the client. We're also going through FIPS for the cryptographic boundary of our virtual mobile device.
To be fair, you kind of got a head start. You know, obviously you were in stealth, but you kind of got a head start because you were given such strong criteria, which kind of guided how you built Hypori.
Yes, and millions of dollars in funding, which helped.
Yes, so, always funding always helps.
Yeah, with, as revenue. So, you know, the fact
hey,
that we
am had, I allowed to ask, are you on a series or are you privately bankrolled or what?
We raised $14 million in an A, which was publicly disclosed in the first half of this year. We're kind of in between right now. We're focused on execution, and you know, we plan to raise a B next year. So when I look at, you know, comparing us to say some of the other VMI vendors, we have raised a lot more revenue. You know, we have raised a multiple on the financing side, and that's just meant that our team is larger. So we're about 45 people, about 15.
You can move more quickly.
Yeah, I mean, it really helps to have customer validation when you're trying to get investors to back you. And, you know, especially also given how far hard it is to build this product, enterprise customers really want to wait for you to hit that minimum viable product before they're going to entertain you that much and start doing pilots and paying and doing deployments. And so, you know, the fact that we have worked closely, so it's helped from a revenue perspective, and then that has helped us with financing. It's also helped from an architectural perspective. So we had to design security in from the start. We have a defense in depth architecture, you know, which is extremely sophisticated, because we had to think through all of the different multi-vector attack points that extremely paranoid people worry about.
So it's fair to say that you have some people with some good security background as part of Hypori.
Yes.
And, you know, let's ask the question that I know is going to come up. I know the answer, but for our listeners, why don't you do that with iOS? I'd love to be able to.
So, you know, Apple's never allowed you to access OS X on your PC, right? You've never been able to go boot up officially, you know, access OS X on, say, a VMware hypervisor. You can do Linux on your Windows desktop, but you can't do OS X. Now, you can run Windows on a VM on top of your MacBook Pro, but you can't run OS X on top of VMware on your Dell PC, right? So the same is true in mobile platforms. You know, Apple owns all of the source code for iOS, and they have license agreements, and you can't just go out and break them. You can't get to the source code, and you'd be breaking the law. You know, they would sue you if you tried to access a remote iOS, you know, VM from a Samsung phone. They would sue you, and rightly so. They've done a lot of investment in that IP. So the difference is, you know, Android is open source. There is no requirement. There's some stuff we can talk to if you're interested on Google and working with Google. But the core source code for the base OS is open source. And that means that we can use it without licensing. It also means we can go in and modify it. And so we would kind of see ourselves as a virtual handset manufacturer, a virtual mobile device manufacturer, because to make this work well over varying network qualities, to make all the sensors work, you have to do a lot of deep work in Android to make that work well. And that's not just like writing an app. That's like wading through the Android frameworks, which is kind of like a undocumented wild west of code.
You have to be an OS engineer. It's not just an application developer.
Yes, OS and kernel. So we hired people from handset manufacturers because of that, and the software teams, because it's, again, it's really hard to do it well. Now, interestingly, Google is actually moving an increasing amount of Android out of the open source edition, the AOSP edition, into the Google licensed edition. Yeah. We talked about this before, but you know, part of the way they want to control the Android ecosystem is by forcing people who are playing in it to go through CTS and to get Google certified.
They're
worried about vendors like CyanogenMod and yes. others who are trying to come in with an alternative build on the Android ecosystem. So, you know, their strategy in doing that has been to move more and more code out of the core AOSP, and that just lets them. And there are good things about that too. They want to be able to ensure everybody's got a good experience on an Android.
So to be fair, you know, if we go back to the Apple piece for a second, you know, one of the reasons Apple doesn't want to share is Apple, has forged a very strong tie between the OS and the hardware, and Google hasn't. And to be fair, part of what you get from that is, depending on what manufacturer you choose, you can get either slightly or vastly different user experience even before they get skinned. You know, but to be fair to Google, one of the reasons Google's pulled a lot of the APIs into their certified services is the fact that they want to be able to update them. You know, one of the issues is Android is very fragmented.
Yeah.
And one way to, you know, secure that and all is to actually own those APIs and be able to update them outside of doing an OS release.
Right. And the other thing is, you know, if I bought a Google device at the Verizon store, right, I bought an Android-based device, and I found that a quarter of the apps that I bought didn't work, I probably wouldn't be very happy. And so part of what Google is doing in CTS and CDD is curating that community to make sure that consumers have good experience with the devices and that all the apps run. And so, you know, there's tests are helping validate that. You know, but we're fans in Hyperia of iOS. I mean, we think it's a great operating system. We have more iPhones in the company than we do Android devices.
Well, it's much easier to demonstrate your technology when you pull out an iPhone and you can show an Android app or an Android handset. So, you know, before we talk about the latest release, because there's one piece in there that has changed a little bit, you know, up till now you get the whole device. So in some ways it's similar to can't remember the name of the company, but VMware originally developed one where you actually had two phones in one. VMware Horizon, but there was another company that's Red something. And I should ask Jack, because he's usually better at remembering these things, that also has a...
A client-side hypervisor. Yeah. I know the company you mean.
Client-side hypervisor. And there are a couple of them that have done that. And, you know, I can understand wanting to do it for security reasons. A lot of times users aren't so happy with it just because of the cognitive dissonance that's there. Which side do I make my phone call on? Which side do I answer my mail in?
Well, I think more than that, fundamentally, that doesn't work for bring your own device.
Well, so you have to buy the right device. How do you turn it on? How do you install it? How do you manage it? So that's an issue. So BYOD is obviously important here. Hmm. So let's talk about this. The experience for me is, I can do it on an Android or an iPhone, but I pull my iPhone out of my pocket. I have an app shortcut that I click, and you know, I'm assuming there's a client side app that's actually there.
So we have a client app that you click and you authenticate. We use two-factor authentication with certificates in the device key store. We use TLS 1.2 for connection to the server, and then you're viewing this remote Android device.
Let's stop there.
Yeah.
My remote Android device, what's it running on the backend?
Yeah, so we're running on top of SE Linux, KVM, QMU, And then SE Android is the you know, the mobile OS. And then we use OpenStack as the kind of management infrastructure, together with VMware's ESX and vSphere platform for high availability of the management node.
So are you? Take it you're probably not running on AWS, although maybe you are. Or where
no,
are you?
Because AWS doesn't support nested virtualization. So we have a great relationship with IBM and SoftLayer.
Okay.
They've been extremely helpful. They've given us credits to use their hardware. They supported us for a demonstration at Mobile World Congress in Barcelona, where we were one of the Innovation Bake Off companies. And so a big difference for SoftLayer is they support bare metal as a service, which Amazon doesn't support. So we can run it on that. We've got a lot of customers running it internally. And then we're looking at telco service providers.
Telco, and if somebody wants, internally, are they running it on vCloud Air? Are they running it on just ESX bare metal?
So typically, they'll run in this latest release, you'll be running the management infrastructure on top of ESX managed by VMware Stack. And then you'll be running the compute nodes. You can run them on top of ESX, or you can run them bare metal.
Bare metal and using KVM and other.
KVM, in both cases, KVM is the hypervisor to the mobile OSs. ESX is capable of nested virtualization, but doesn't technically support it under the support agreement today. But we can run on a single server for demos and things, and we run nested. And then if you're scaling it out, you tend to run the compute nodes bare metal.
Okay, so we got the backend. You've talked about how you log in. You have a client app. There's another, I want to talk about transport in a second, but I log in. And essentially, I'm taken into an Android screen. I'm assuming an Android home screen, which is it's got all the apps that I've installed on it and that my users can access.
So Android supports applications called launchers. And launchers are the home screen of Android.
Yes.
So that's how Samsung makes their thing look different than LG, makes theirs look different than somebody else's. So there's a stock Android launcher, and you can run that if you like. And it's exactly the experience you would get from a Nexus phone. But we've also created a bypass launcher, which runs the UI for the launching of applications within the client. So there's no latency of rendering transition effects. And then the bypass launcher we've created, the ACE launcher, it also doesn't expose things like widgets. And so we aim for the lowest common denominator mobile experience so that an iOS user coming to it doesn't see any new user interface elements. It's exactly what they were used to. And so if you're an Android Power user and you want to flip it and go and access to widgets, we have the ability to do that either through changing the launcher or through your dashboard. But, we used a bypass launcher to make it feel more, easier for an iOS user.
To feel more native.
Yes.
So let's now talk about the transport. So, because obviously that's important. You got 3G, you got 4G, you have Wi-Fi.
Right.
Phones are moving in and out of that.
Yes, it's extremely hard. So this comes back to my comment that it's easy to build a demo that works well over great Wi-Fi. Doing real-time network optimizations is challenging. So it affects things like touch. Latency affects touch. You see all kinds of weird bouncing behavior, which we've seen on a lot of the competitive, VMI products because they haven't dealt with what latency means to how Android interprets touch.
And to be fair, I'm a huge person. I talk about user experience all the time. And easiest way to get people to not use, I don't care how secure you are, I don't care how required it is, easiest way to get people to stop using it is not provide a user experience which is akin to when they're using their iPhone or Android phone natively. So how do you, what are you using for transport and how do you handle those latencies?
So we started with SPICE as the basis of the remote access protocol, which is a Red Hat technology. We forked it and significantly modified it. We moved from, for example, MJPEG to H.264, and then we started doing special things in H.264 to make it work well for a remote mobile OS. And so there's really kind of three areas that I gently remind our developers about whenever we're in the office. The first one is, how do I reduce the impact of network latency? How do I move rendering to the client? How do I do bypass type operations to move, the place the UI is rendered to deal with, as I say. So that's one aspect of dealing with latency. Another one is how do you condition the data so that the OS behaves right, even if you're in a higher latency environment. So touch bouncing is an example of that. A second one is, how do you get better at not sending the same data to the endpoint twice and dynamically changing the compression levers and things to optimize based on the available network bandwidth? And that's harder than it sounds. Because there's lots of ways that you can eke out additional savings of data being sent across the network, but they tend to have a inverse correlation to compute you need on the server side. So optimizing around recognizing when it's the same data and not sending it again, that's hard. And then the third one is latency is just physics. If you're on the other side of the world, you're going to have a bad experience accessing a remote OS. And so we built, you know, initially for our DoD customers, but also in the commercial world now, as we're starting to scale up systems, we're seeing this requirement for more global systems and the need to roam the user's virtual mobile device. So, you know, a way to cut down latency is to have the virtual mobile device follow the user. And we support distributed compute nodes in a geographical fabric. And it then, you know, the user, when they pop up somewhere else, it can effectively, you know, start a new VM, point it at their storage, help move them across to give them
sort of vMotion, using my term, what I'm familiar with, and maybe, you know, with what you're using, that's probably not the actual mechanism, but move their user session to closer to where they are to obviously give them the best experience.
Right, and you know, there are techniques to separate the user's data volumes from the OS, so it's more like starting a stateless desktop on a new VM
and then adding the state to the data.
Right, and then mounting the user's data volume.
So let's dig a little bit deeper into this. You have this control app that sits on the user's device. I'm going to assume that you use that to access the sensors.
Yes.
So GPS, all the different sensors. What can you access? What don't you access?
Right.
What do you actually have to... I'm not using the native app or the native hardware. I'm proxying some stuff. What are you doing there?
So we access the orientation. So when you twist the device, it twists remotely.
I would think that would be probably the most important thing.
It's definitely important.
After touch.
We don't remote the whole of the accelerometer feed, because if we did, we'd flood the network. Every time you'd slightly twist your wrist, it would send more packets. So
I shouldn't be playing a racing game on this.
No, not today. We plan in the future on dealing with accelerometer for apps that require it in an intelligent way. But our first kind of foray was to say we're going to detect orientation on the client and make changes. We do GPS, Wi-Fi, and cell tower-based location, and we do it in an intelligent way that only sends that data when it's needed. We remote the microphone. We remote all the different microphones on the phone, so we sync microphone status.
Obviously, the speaker.
Yes, we do the speaker.
How about the camera?
Yeah, so we remote the camera. Today, in the current release, we remote it for taking photos and for live streaming video like VTC. We prioritize VTC because that's one of the big apps that people want to use.
I would think for the DoD, they want to see who they're talking to.
Yeah.
I can understand where that became a priority.
And in commercial too. I mean, Link is a big requirement. You know, Link, Java, different VTC applications. So,
But no video. I can't record video yet.
Yeah, you can't record a video clip yet and send it. It's the next thing to do. When we prioritized, we found very few people were that bothered about in the business world. If, you know, nobody's trying to record a Vine video of themselves. You know, it's just not.
So how about things like the proximity sensor, pressure sensor, altimeter, those sorts of things?
Yeah, so we haven't. So one more comment on camera. There's two ways to do camera, and we've actually done both of them. One is to do a bypass camera, which is how I think everybody else has implemented camera right now in the other competitors. That takes a photo effectively locally and then sends it to the server. You have a special camera app to do that. The good thing with it is that it's instantaneous as you move the camera around. The bad side is that it doesn't work for any apps that have an embedded camera. And so we actually made remote camera work as well. And then we made, you know, remote live streaming work so the VTC apps would work. So we're ahead of where everybody else is on camera right now. And then in terms of the other sensors, We are, I'm wondering what I can say here.
Only say what you're willing to be public, because this is a public podcast. So,
yeah, see, we're working other things. We haven't done, so the proximity sensor, if I put the phone up to my face, it's going to actually, the proximity's on the local phone turns the screen off. So remoting it is actually not that valuable because it's already.
Well, I would think that you might want to know when the screen's off just because, you know, one of those things.
Yeah, we haven't found any use cases where it's mounted yet. You know, the barometer and there aren't many apps that use those in a meaningful way.
Today,
yes. And,
how about, do you do Bluetooth? When you think about the sensors out there and what you may be using devices for, and I can't see whether you're wearing an Apple Watch or not, but, you know, all these different devices out there, whether they're fitness things, whether it's, you know, hooking up to your car and being able to Bluetooth mic through your car or something like that. Does that work? Not?
So Bluetooth audio devices work. Bluetooth keyboards work in 3.1, our latest release. We added support for that. In terms of the whole Bluetooth framework, we will have that done by the end of the year.
You're not there yet, but you're working on it.
I know about the whole, but we'll have a very large proportion of Bluetooth devices working remotely. And we have a specific customer in that space that has been driving us to make Bluetooth peripherals work. It's actually a commercial customer in the credit card industry. It's something that we're actively working.
Okay. So I get in, I can use an app. So I have this desktop. I'm going to go back to the VDI language. Is this a persistent state, non-persistent? How are you doing this?
So you can actually do both. You can persist or not persist, and we can suspend and resume VMs. The thing to think about is notifications. Like, people expect push notifications to work. So when I get an email, I expect my phone to buzz. So we've built a notification proxy service that effectively subscribes to the notifications in the local device and then can sanitize them via a notification server and push them to the endpoint. And then if you click the notification, it will go show you that content in the VM. So order for that to work, you have to have the VM running because Outlook has to talk to Exchange and the chat app has to talk to the chat server. And so all of those apps are running in the VM. They're getting content from the rest of the enterprise, pushing it into the notification service, and then we're subscribing to that and syncing it.
I'm assuming
workers, you'd want that to work. Task workers, you don't care, and so you're gonna, you know, you could suspend them very quickly once they, you know.
Are you able to reap savings from the fact that when people aren't using their device, you still have to leave that VM running for persistent VMs? Can you run that at lower power, or are you stuck with?
Right.
You know, anybody who's running persistent, I got all these VMs up and running.
So the advantage of Android is that it's designed to be able to sip battery when you're not actively using it. And so the resting state battery usage is the resting state CPU usage is minuscule. Interestingly, in our performance test, if you have very high active concurrency, the CPU is typically the constraining factor. If you have a lot of resting state users, you tend to run out of RAM first.
Okay, and now each user gets their own VM, or is there any sharing, or how are you?
Each user gets their own VM. You can suspend and resume them. And that's actually another critical difference between us and all the other VMI vendors today. So when we started out, we looked at the two architectures, more of a Windows Terminal Center or RDSH kind of architecture, using SE Android containers, having multiple users within a single Android OS, and then running that on a hypervisor. So it's similar to multiple users in a terminal server environment, or more of a VDI architecture where you have one VM per user, which is really what, you know, VMware is more pushed that. I guess Citrix is more started in the terminal server area, right? So based on the interactions with our customer set, they pushed us towards a VM per user. And one of the reasons for that is, you know, better security. We use SE Android policy. We can run compartments in the SE Android guest OS. We then use the KVM hypervisor, and then we use SE Linux policy underneath. So we have multiple layers of user isolation. If you purely use an SE Android-based mechanism for separation, you are reliant on that OS as the only way to, you know, to, so if you're using a terminal server architecture, you only have the user separation mechanism from a security perspective. And then the other problem is you can't as easily move the users between servers. You can't as easily upgrade some users and not others as part of a DevOps kind of rolling upgrade strategy. And so really we do have more of a focus on the device and the integrity of the device, whereas the other vendors have gone this, you know, all of them have gone the SE Android container kind of route and route, to use my American. And they are...
No, we like the British accent.
So the SE Android route. And
it's a router, not a router.
Yes. So they've gone that way. And, you know, there, it is a trade-off. There are pluses and negatives.
There are reasons to do one and reasons to do the other.
Yeah.
So
one other thing I wanted to mention. Sure. We talked about the user experience on iOS. So in 3.1, which we've just released, we're the first, you know, VMI vendor to provide a seamless capability. So we have the seamless apps capability we just announced here.
So this is exactly where we want to go. Your new version, 3.1, explain what seamless apps means.
So people still worry about, you know, I'm an iPhone user and I don't want to have to learn Android, right? And even if you mask some of it with, you know, a launcher and a user experience that's designed around, you know, around a common denominator, you can still see a notification bar, bottom buttons, things like that, settings, other things of the device. And so, you know, that and for instances where the customer just wants to show one app, they don't want the whole device. They've just got, I've got Link and I want to offer it up as a secure lightweight service. Or I've got an online banking app and I want to move that to the cloud and, you know, make it more secure than having it run on all of my customers' endpoints. And so for that, we built this ability to run in a seamless mode where you can click apps and you can create shortcuts to them from the phone's home screen. Now, it's not just a shortcut. It means I get a little app, you know, with kind of a little symbol on it saying it's delivered by the Hypori platform, the H platform. And I can have, say, five of those on my iOS home screen. And one will open Link, another one will open Chrome, another one will open Outlook.
So it's removing the desktop and launching you directly into the app. So from a user's experience, it's just another app on my device.
Yes, and just like seamless windowing in Unity in VMware really made a big jump forwards in providing more of a single user experience by stripping away the Windows desktop when I was on, you know, a MacBook Pro. It just looked like that Microsoft Outlook was running within OS X, right? Similarly, we have stripped out the Android user interface elements. So I see the iOS top notification bar. I see the iOS user experience. I don't actually, the user never knows that there's Android involved. They never
I'm going to guess from your side, you put a single user's all their apps on a single VM, so you can still do the separation. Is it one app, or do I have the client app plus the launcher?
So you have...
Out of curiosity.
So today in our release, you have the client app, which has effectively an app picker. And so when you click into it, it shows you all the apps that are available to you in the VM. And then you can pick which ones you want to create shortcuts to in your desktop or in your iPhone home screen.
So what? So
which ones you don't.
Okay, so...
Or your Android.
The user does that, or does the administrator...
So the administrator determined what apps are available to the user. Mm-hmm. And then the user goes in and decides which ones they want to create shortcuts to.
So it's almost another app catalog. In a way to look at it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a set of apps that are being made available to you, and then you compress them and create a shortcut. Now, we do expect, you know, moving forwards, we plan on doing kind of a first-class apps kind of thing where, you know, each app can stand alone and have an embedded client around it. Our ambition longer term is to integrate that with the EMM front end so you can use
AirWatch, MobileWire, right? The like.
And that's actually one... You know, as your listeners try and differentiate the different VMI vendors that have come out, a unique thing that we've done that none of the others have is we allow ARM native applications to run on our platform. We did a special deal with Intel to make that be true, and so we are an Intel supported handset, essentially similar to an Atom based device. So we have this set of libraries, and it turns out that all of the EMM clients historically have been using ARM native function calls to manage the device. And they relied on these Intel libraries to allow Atom-based devices to be managed by MDM. So you can drop the AirWatch MDM client into our virtual mobile device, and it'll pop up on the AirWatch dashboard just like any other virtual smartphone. The same with Mobileye and the same with Goods MDM. And that's important because people have invested in those technologies. They're good platforms.
And so they still want to be able to manage what's in there, make it, there's still pieces to manage as far as distributing stuff.
Yeah, we didn't want to recreate that whole ecosystem. There's already a great set of vendors out there
people
doing
do
it.
People do that. Then, let them do that. You want to concentrate on
it. And it's just like VDI.
Well.
I mean, in VDI, you could use Tivoli, you could use Symantec, McAfee to manage Windows desktops. And you don't care if they're physical or if they're virtual. The same platform will manage both. So we're the only vendor, we're the only Intel-based vendor today where that's true in VMI.
Okay.
And almost all the vendors today are running on Intel-based servers. The only one that's an exception to that isn't actually here at Brightform. They're Sierraware. They're running on an ARM appliance. But all the other ones that are here, are running on Intel chipset.
So x86. We're going to wrap up in a couple minutes. So let's ask a couple, I don't know if they're tough questions, but let's be clear. You're running VMI. If you walk out of Wi-Fi or cellular service, I can't use you.
Yeah, so the offline one is one of the top five questions or objections we hear. And Jack did a good job of covering that here in the VMI session. And I've heard them talk about it in virtual desktops too. So, Brian Madden would say that, and has said recently, there is the ability to check out a Windows VM in VDI, but almost nobody uses it. In fact, he can't really think of anybody, he said in the speech that was using it. Because there's other ways to deal with that. You can run local VMs. Lots of people are doing that.
Sure.
But checking in and out VMs, people just, in production, it hasn't been used that much.
And to be fair, Jack did cover it well. I don't fully agree with Jack. I'm originally from the pharmaceutical industry. And, we would put salespeople in hospitals where there was no Wi-Fi and they had to turn off their cellular signal because it could interfere with patient equipment and all.
Right.
I also think that although we like to think networking is ubiquitous, it isn't. And we're used to using our devices wherever they are. We're used to being able to open our email wherever we are, whether it's in a car, whether it's in a tunnel, something else. So let's approach that two ways. Number one, what do you do in sporadic? So, I drop out for a couple seconds. That's really not, I may see a freeze, but do I actually drop the session?
Right.
Versus, obviously, you don't work in offline. And no one else does. So let's be fair there. That's not it's a limitation of VMI. It's not necessarily a knock against VMI unless you need it. If you need it, it's an issue.
So I think in terms of the session dropouts, our protocol is pretty resistant to that. The session will typically stay alive and then come back and replay the touch actions or whatever it is that you clicked. It doesn't just keep dropping. And then because we preserve state on the server side, it's not like you're going to lose the email that you were writing. You connect back, the VM's still running, you're happy. If you connect back a lot later and it's suspended, you still resume to the same state. In terms of the I'm totally offline use case, the one that the majority of people ask about is email. And most apps, Jack said this at Synergy, said it here again today, most mobile apps expect some kind of network connectivity. Most do.
At some point, absolutely. On the other hand, I can't name the number of times I've been, I like to use San Francisco and I knock on the fact that Verizon in San Francisco is completely useless. And yes, I know I have Verizon listeners out there. I'm sorry. I walk with two devices. On the other hand, I'll knock AT&T. I've had similar issues in New York City. It really depends which device you have and where you are, bandwidth and everything else.
So that's interesting. So, one point I would make and I haven't made yet is that, we work from tablets and phones. You can have a single virtual mobile device. So if you really have to have an AT&T phone and a Verizon phone or your dual SIM or whatever, you can actually connect from your Verizon phone. And if it drops because you got bad signal and you got an AT&T iPad, then you can pick up where you left off on your AT&T iPad.
That's actually pretty cool. I don't think that everybody goes to the extremes I do, but I've been in the business a long time.
Some cases, people have multiple devices. The second one would be, there are great vendor products out there to help with offline access. I mean, AirWatch has AirWatch Inbox. It's a great product. Good does a good container with email. So for the email use case of I'm on the plane and, you know, I'm in the middle of the Pacific and I've got nothing, you know, that's a, that's what we would typically say. And if there's an app that you're building that's a custom app, that's like we had one bank say, well, we've got 2,000 people that go out into India and sign up customers. Great example of where to use, you know, an AirWatch custom encoded app. You know, build the app, put it in the AirWatch container. Great, you know, wrap it with AirWatch.
So to be fair, we would coexist
with that. And what we would say is that we're uniquely able to deliver any commercial mobile app, you know, native applications as a secure, lightweight service from the cloud without having to take over the user's endpoint with an aggressive policy.
As long as you have connectivity, and
we coexist.
I like to hear here is that you know your limitations, and you know.
Yes, there's no silver bullet to this, and it's not like I've bought technology from one vendor for my Windows desktop, right? I've got lots of different things, and you're going to end up spending more money on mobile devices as you really see this enterprise transformation of mobile applications in the enterprise, which really hasn't happened much yet. There's custom apps, but there's not like there are hundreds of thousands of commercial mobile apps being written for enterprise users by third-party vendors today. There's actually some data app figures released showing that there are more. The growth in business category apps on the app stores is higher than any other category.
To be fair, the money's in the enterprise apps. I do think that, you know. I do have one last question for you, but before that, I do, you know, the comment I'll make is I don't think that most of the enterprise app vendors start in Android, which to me makes it a little bit harder for what you do. But I think that, you know, when the use case is there, and I think that Android's ramping up, but, you know, there's still, you know, the numbers like 78% of, enterprises are iOS, at least if they're providing the devices, and some are, forcing it,
so that's changing. You know, like three years ago, when we spoke to people, they would say, "Well, look, our mobile strategy is an iOS strategy, and that's it." Now we don't really find anybody who's saying that. Everybody has to have an Android strategy, and because Android has, I don't know, 70%+ of the ecosystem of endpoints, not in the enterprise but globally, most software vendors are building for iOS and Android. They aren't building for Windows or BlackBerry, but they are building for iOS and Android. And there's tools and things to try and make it easier to build apps that are portable across both.
So last question. I rock an Android probably 80% of the year. I usually carry two devices. I need to know what I'm playing with. What do you do when an app has a memory leak, gets stuck, something else, it freezes? I mean, you're emulating an Android, and let's be fair. And by the way, the same thing happens in iOS. This is not a knock on Android itself. It's more, I'm a user. And all of a sudden, my app got wonky. Either how do I stop it, or my whole device got a little wonky. What do I do?
Technically, we're running an Android OS compiled for x86 on a virtualized platform, not emulating per se. But
which still means it's going to have its wonky times here.
Sure,
and absolutely. I can't just say, you know, the help desk can't say, don't worry about it. We're going to call up Justin. All of a sudden, you get a call that says, this stuff is bollocks. Come on, fix this stuff for me.
Yes, that's a good English word. You can shut the app. You can force stop the app within the virtual mobile device and restart it. And it's true. Apps are flaky on physical devices sometimes, not just virtual ones. So the same capability exists. You can go into settings, stop the app, restart it. You can go into your recent apps and flick it away.
Can I do that for my virtual device?
Yes.
So I can actually...
It's just like a regular smartphone, right? I can halt the app. I can go to recent apps, just slide it across and shut it. And then we also...
I'm the user. I'm using it. And it looks, you know, I quit that app and my device is still a little wonky. And I, you know, it's just like we've seen on Android, because it's not emulated. It's an actual handset based upon what you're doing. Do I have a way to reset it, shut it down and restart it?
Yeah, so you can restart that virtual mobile device just like powering off and powering on the smart, you know, physical phone.
So that's part of the client.
So there is a mechanism to do that. And then the other thing is that because we have a full Android virtual OS with the settings app there, where you can actually do a bug report in the virtual mobile device. So you can go into settings, you can go into the bug reporting function, and it will generate a bug that will describe whatever, it'll generate a report that pops up in your VM, and then you can forward it to your support desk.
Excellent. Excellent. So I want to wrap up here. Any last words, Justin?
I guess, you know, we got our start in defense, but we have now aggressively moved into commercial and healthcare. We are growing. we do see very broad use cases for VMI. Now, that doesn't mean it solves every problem, but VDI doesn't solve every problem. And it's got less
Nothing solves every problem.
And VDI's got less than 10% of enterprise desktops, but there's some pretty large vendors that are doing okay in VDI. So, you know,
you'll take 10%.
I'll take 10% of the enterprise mobility, you know, endpoint market. And that's kind of like we see lots of use code. The question is, what's the business process, the set of apps and the set of users and data that I want to make available on this platform?
How do we help you solve this? So,
yeah. And so typically it is a consultative engagement model. You end up at a whiteboard. You end up with use case you'd never have thought about sometimes, and then some that you have, you know, especially where VDI is strong. But I think it is going to end up becoming a significant part of the enterprise mobility ecosystem, the bag of tricks. And the better VMI vendors will integrate with the rest of the ecosystem, like the AirWatches and MobileIons of the world. But it is, almost every organization we've spoken to sees use cases, and it's coming down to how do I get started, validate this works in a low risk, kind of easy, rapid way, and then think about what other things could this help you with?
Excellent. Thank you, Justin. Excellent for you to make some time to appear on the Mobilecast.
No, thanks for having me.
And to the listeners, this has been episode 204, and we'll be coming to you soon with episode 205. Already have it lined up. And from here in Denver, take care.